my voice starts to fade off, do put your hand up. It's kind of, it's interesting coming out of silence and having to having to speak, especially with you all sitting at the back there. So we're on the eve of the full moon. It's a full moon tomorrow night, so we monks will have, we have a little ceremony that we have. It's also Good Friday, so it's kind of an auspicious time. Just got a Ajahn Buddhadhamma, got an email from Andrew in India. He'll probably give you more detail, I guess. But Anna seems to be doing quite well, considering she's still quite sick. But she is recovering. And Andrew's enjoying green coconuts and 35 degrees. So it's nice to, you know, although there's still seems to be some problem there, it's nice to hear that things are looking positive. So I thought I'd invite you on a little journey this evening. It's not far. I don't know if you're up for that. A little journey into the present moment. And it's I was thinking this afternoon about giving a talk, and my mind is a little bit. Parts of it anyway are a little bit like a kind of ongoing Monty Python sitcom. So I came up with this image of, you know, the present moment tour. I don't know. I guess they have certainly historical places of interest in Europe. You know, they have these people wandering around with an umbrella with a flower on it or a stick with a balloon or something, and they're the kind of tour leader and people following along behind while they point out salient features of the present moment. I'm sure we've all dipped into it at odd times during the retreat. But I thought it'd be nice if we could all kind of just come together at the same time in the present moment. I also enjoy playing around with words, because the trouble with Dhamma, well, not the trouble, but the thing with Dhamma is it's essentially it's ineffable. What can one say about the present moment? No, it's like this. we can describe aspects of this, you know, the temperature and the light, and we can count the number of people and things. But that's not the present moment. That's just cutting bits off. The present moment itself, it's kind of a funny, because it's like it's such a sometimes seems like such a slender sliver of real estate, kind of pressed. But you know, on one side you've got this kind of monolithic, huge mass of the past, you know, with all of the memories and thoughts and views and opinions and the traumas and the joys and all of the images. You know, like it's almost got like a juggernaut kind of pressing in, impelling me forward. We're so motivated and driven by the past, by our conditioning. And then on the other side, we have this kind of, you know, this enormously infinite empty space, the potentiality of the future. And they both seem so solid and so substantial sometimes. And in the present moment, it's this kind of thin little bit as we hop between one and the other, the past and the future, we occasionally get glimpses of. It is sometimes disturbing, you know, when it's particularly accentuated by contrast in a situation like this, where the past and future are allowed, or we have the possibility of allowing the past and future to fade. So we don't have to think, we don't have to do anything, we don't have to keep track of the time particularly. If you're sitting and the bell rings, you go walk. If you're walking and the bell rings, you come sit. And then there's the meal is an exception, and so on and so. It's very simple. also I tend to notice by contrast that there is this intention, this suggestive movement towards the present moment, towards stillness. And as I said earlier, I try and see it very much as a relative thing. We can kind of beat out this shoulds and shouldn'ts. I should be able to abide in the present moment. We can set this up as a demand, as a very high expectation we can have, rather than just inclining towards a sense of a relative movement. And as we practice developing any skill, the more we practice, so our intention or our inclination is gradually realized. That's true of anything, any skill, playing the piano, riding a bicycle, abiding in the present moment. But we have to set that up. We have to kind of put that kind of post, that reference point. We have to establish that in the mind. So opportunities like this are just so incredibly valuable for doing that. You know, it's like getting some old tarnished thing out and polishing it up. We can forget how illumined or how bright and shiny the mind can be. And then after a few days or a few weeks or a few months or whatever, after the retreat, if we don't maintain, you know, give it the odd buff now and then, once a day, twice a day, once a week, whatever, there's no fixed thing, but I'm sure most of you appreciate the value in doing that. Certainly opportunities like this, it is a really wonderful opportunity to re-establish that brightness in the mind, that sense of stillness, the sense of the present moment. And it is a present. Present moment is a present. It's a gift. We're kind of perpetual recipients of grace. That this has arisen, all that it is, and this is where language gets a bit difficult, because we tend to create the present moment as a thing. You know, there's the past, there's the future, there's the present moment, and they're distinct, kind of separate things somehow. We take a tour of the present moment, we dip into it, and then we go off to the past. But I mean, that's we do that unconsciously. When you think about it, it's kind of obvious. This lovely phrase of Ajahn Sumedho's, you know, the past is just a memory, the future is the unknown, and now is the knowing. And you think of it, that's true. So I have a memory of the past in the present moment. I speculate and I do my planning. I think about the future, what we call the future. I do that in the present moment. So all that there is always here. Everything that ever was and everything that will ever be is always here. Which is not to kind of, again, thinking of the past as some kind of thing, you know, like Doctor Who, he hops in it's an English thing, he hops in a telephone box, a time machine, and goes off to this place called the past. And to suggest that all that there is always here is not saying that, you know, the historical things, it's just here in some other dimension or something. But when it arises as a memory, it's always here. When it arises as a speculation or a vision of the future or an idea of the future, it's always here. So this phrase that we chant, that the knower of the worlds, and that I often just contemplating omniscience, all-knowing. But what the Buddha knew was what there is to know. This is one thought. I mean, whether or not he was capable of, you know, that you hear about him with his divine eye, he could see all these different things. I don't know about that. But what I imagine that a Buddha does know is the true nature of this, So all that there is always here, and it can be known. I can't know this. My sense organs and so forth. It's not here. But I can. The potentiality of knowing the truth of the way things are is always exists in the present moment. It's just that we tend to view things or apprehend things through various filters, and certainly aspects of the past and thoughts about the future compile a large part of those filters. So the present moment as a gift, this sense of grace. I grew up in a Christian culture, and I kind of, there are aspects of the language, like the sense of grace, I really, as a counterbalance to the sense of self-empowerment or self-actualization, that, you know, the question, you know, if we live the present moment is a gift, it is a present, so then we tend to think, or the thought arises, well, who who was graceful or gracious enough to give us this? And in theistic terminology, the answer starts with a G. I'm sure you can guess. But that in the Buddhist context, that question, who, the wise old owl, who was wise for constantly asking such a question, who? So it's not, you know, in Buddhism there's no personification, there's no external force or person or that created, there's no creationist theory, but to consider that, and not setting this up as kind of dogma or as a position, that in effect we gave us this. So this present moment, we created this. There was notices put out. Someone in the group put notices. Arsalan collected names and organised things, and somebody made a booking, and then somebody came and put the mats out. And we created this. And then again, the limitations or the way that the discriminatory mind is still dualistic. That we. You know, the Ottawa Buddhist Society, we, that's us, and then there's them. But, you know, who built the building? Well, they built the building. We organised this, and they built the building. But this as an experience is homogenous. It's not. See, the building was built in the past, and the mats were put out in the past, but the present moment just is the way it is. So one of the terms, again in the chanting, the third of the five khandhas, this term sankhara, in the chanting it's mental formations. In the context of the five khandhas, it's usually presented as a mental aspect. But the term sankhara, it's quite a complex one. It has kind of three levels of meaning. I think three. It's always a risk when you these things with numbers. You've got to get them all right. One, two, three. So so in terms of formations, there is this has been formed, and it is a formative. It has a formative quality to it as well. So this came into being as a result of intentions, actions, and this is the springboard for what we conventionally think of as the next moment. So this sankhara has both a sense of the past as that which has been formed and that which is forming, and then there is the former, quality of intention, which we individually and collectively, and that's where it starts to this question of who, because there is a sense of individuality, and then there is the obvious experience of collective activity. So we all play a part in this, and the it starts to go kind of wrong or go off the rails when desire starts to come in. So it's this idea of seizing the moment. This is a kind of an encouragement, you know, that's seen as a good thing, that one should seize the moment because I want it to be mine and I want to control it according to the pleasure-pain principle. Because if I can control it, then I can make sure that no unpleasant things come in and only pleasant things can be here. But the impossibility of that is kind of obvious, and the more this I don't know if you've seen the movie The Lord of the Rings, this character Gollum, he so personifies that, you know, his search for the precious, because it's his and he wants it. Because in the possession of the ring is possession of power, total and ultimate. It's the one ring that unites all. It's the ultimate dictatorship. It's the possession of the ring, and it personifies that position of power. And there is that tendency to want to have that, moving towards. Because in the position of power, we can control. It can be all pleasant and no unpleasant. And this is, again, in theistic terminology, it's maybe a bit old-fashioned, but the way heaven is created, it's kind of like this, but with just the pleasant bits. And that's what we want, isn't it? I mean, hands up everybody who wants to go to heaven. And nirvana is often thought of in the same way. You know, when I get enlightened, you know, I won't have any pains in my knee. I won't have this problem. I won't get the flu and everybody will like me. No one will argue with me. It'll be just great. I'll be enlightened. But it's not. That's not the present moment. Just by its nature is unpossessable. It can't be. The unified theory, you know, in terms of the idea of we, that collectively, you know, the universe is conscious and we're actually running it. But there's no control. At best, there's participation or cooperation, that we all have a say, or we all have a vote to greater and lesser degrees in this. But that control is not possible. And it's in the exercise of that vote that we need to maintain mindfulness. This is the point of choice is how we, in terms of this term sankhara, mental formations, our intention or our volition is what conditions our world. So we do have individual experience. So some of those individual choices I will experience and you won't. So in terms of the, like, we creating this, there is this kind of paradoxical element that some of my mental formations, some of my intentions, only I will experience. And how the maths of that, or how the science of that works, I wouldn't even begin to consider. The basic underlying principle in terms of the present moment, or in terms of this whole kind of pivotal point, this razor's edge on which we walk, the basic principle is good intention or good action, good karma, has good result, good outcome. And bad intention or bad action has bad result. And it can't really be pinned down any more precisely than that. It's our sense of inclination or the power or the quality of our intention is what determines it. So in terms of who created this, or who's in charge, or, you know, in terms of the present moment and the unfolding, we can only operate from the perspective that we have, which is one of delusion, and that's the. So it's like until I know, or until I'm enlightened, I have to allow that many of my decisions, or my conclusions, or my view of the world is distorted, and that how important it is to allow that, or to accept that, and through that acceptance there's forgiveness. So I make mistakes. How could it be otherwise? Until I'm enlightened, that will always be the case. Another, in terms of like language, the present moment is a present, a gift that is given. It is a given, both as a, is it a verb when something is given, and it is a given as a noun. Just to be able to see that this present moment is the way it is. It can't be otherwise. It has to be like this. Right now, the temperature, the people in the room, this in terms of the formation, like those actions, if we can use that, like the conventional sense, past actions have culminated. This culmination is a given. It will change. We can reflect on that. But in terms of like who I am, as part of this, to be able to accept that, and there's forgiveness in that also. That at this particular point in time, this present moment, this one, I'm like this. My age, my gender, my accent, my intelligence, my sense of humour, so on and so forth. It is like this. To be able I can see good bits and bad bits, or what I would define as good bits and bad bits, and it's not to condone or just say, well, I accept that, and you have to accept it too. And when I kind of dump on you or something, well, just accept it because this is how I am. It's not a kind of a blanket excuse. But when I see things, or I remember something that I did, or even somebody reflects back to me something, you know, when you say that, so-and-so, and I remember saying it, and then there's a whole, what is there, this guilt, this remorse, this embarrassment, or whatever, unnecessary. I mean, there is this teaching on shame, Hiriotapa. Like moral dread or shame is a useful quality, but the way that we can create a whole realm of suffering for ourselves, rather than just saying, accepting, yes, I did say that, and where can we go from here? What's, rather than getting caught up in the whole what I should have said, or what I could have said, often when we, I always do it after talks. The thought comes up, oh, I missed the bit about what I should have said. And if I'd have said that, it would have been the perfect talk. My gosh. And I kind of beat myself up less and less with that kind of thing. Because what's been said, and it is as good as it is, and you know, Ajahn Vee say, like collecting skills. Public speaking is a skill that it's one I'm working on. So I enjoy these opportunities to kind of hone my skills, I guess. This is how it works. Until we try these things, practice forgiveness, loving kindness, sitting still, all these different suggestions, these life skills, the practice of Dhamma. Until we try them, we never know how good we are, where our shortcomings are, where our strengths are. And the appreciation of that is always in the present moment. The more still that we can be in that moment, the more able we are to notice the truth or the true nature or the actual quality of the moment. So often this rushing between past and future, we miss the details of the actual. We're kind of lost in the blur of presumptions and perceptions. Taking the time to actually stop and look and to listen, particularly here, is very important. I was going to also talk a bit about meditation practice, kind of not unrelated to the idea of the present moment. One of the Ajahn Viradhamma has been talking a lot about, like, using the body as a meditation object. The body is always in the present moment. Something really, really, you know, that sense of being grounded, that expression. The body is as the earth element, is always present now. The breath, you're always breathing now. So orienting awareness, consciousness, mindfulness around these kinds of things help to establish the mind, because the mind is so quick, so flighty. It can be, in terms of time and space, just in an instant, it can be 1,000 miles away, 1,000 years from now. But the body, much more stable. These images of stability and equanimity that Ajahn's been using, seeing the body as an image of that. A technique I've been working with for a while now is embodying experience. This is kind of the phrase that I've been using. Because experience so often is expressed or thought about, and that's it, it's a thought. We think about experience, or we experience our life or images or sounds or concepts so often in the head as thought or thinking. So I've been experimenting with shifting the seat of consciousness. I mean, physiologically, where we experience things, I mean, I don't know that that's been determined scientifically. You know, where experience actually takes place, whether it's, I mean, obviously the brain is in there somewhere. But there is a kind of a subconscious presumption that life takes place, or experience happens in the brain. I certainly notice thinking, thought, is a kind of very brain-related, head-related. So I've been experimenting with just shifting the seat of consciousness, is how I think of it, into the heart. Actually, I mean, I start off by bringing attention to the physical center of the heart, and sometimes actually I really like tactile or tangible, you know, this thing about moving your lips and wiggling your fingers and things like that. There's something about being able to actually bring something into the tangible, I find, or you know, like concepts into physical experience. So I find just sometimes just touching the heart or massaging the heart. I quite often do that quite vigorously. Just give it a really good rub. It brings literally a physical glow to the heart center. And it also which makes it easier to bring attention or to hold attention or to sustain attention in that area of the body. So I have an image of, you know, literally like a seat, not a kind of armchair, but kind of like a seat where consciousness sits. and it's quite difficult. Oh, I find it difficult, and it's something I'm practicing with, but I find it quite effective when I can observe the world through the heart's eye. I can kind of, it's almost like take all of this and kind of pop it down here and kind of open up a door. Look around. So quickly it wants to go up, especially visually. You know, visual consciousness is so connected with the eyes. Like with the eyes closed, I was listening to when the bell was tolling. I was using that image of stillness. I was holding the, imagining like the heart as a space, and the tolling of the bell kind of like little dandelions, you know, those little fluffy seed things that you use as a clock. The tolling of the bell, like these little white seed things just floating in the, holding that in the heart as an experience. I mean, it's just the way my mind works, but bringing the seat of consciousness into the embodying experience, and I've been using the heart. You can, if you wish, experiment. It is a very traditional, in terms of the yogic system with the energy centers, the chakras and so forth. It's an emotional seat. It's a very kind of powerful part of our physical energetic makeup. I find when I can observe, there's more neutrality, a kind of an inclination towards dispassion, not like neutering experience, but it takes the head somehow is so quick in relation to perception and the value system. Just holding the thought or holding the sound or holding the image in the heart, but somehow it's softer. I don't know what the words, the suggestion, I mean, to experiment with. One, just the idea of exploring the seat of consciousness, or where does experience take place. Two, the possibility of shifting that point of awareness or the seat of consciousness. We do have this kind of ability to, we can direct using the mind. You know, we can focus center our attention very specifically. Say in the palm of the hand or on the end of your big toe. Or we can do that with the mind. So I also like, just as a... I like the image of mental fitness. So as an exercise in like part of my kind of mental workout, if you like, shifting it from here and putting it in another posture. It's like a yoga asana. You kind of try one, just experimenting with different ways of posturing the body. Similarly, experimenting with different ways of posturing the mind. We get so habituated in terms of presuming that the mind is kind of like this. The past is like this. The future is like this. My mind is like this. I am like this. It's often not until we challenge some of those presumptions in different ways. I mean, so this suggestion of relocating the seat of consciousness, you may or may not want to try that, but just the suggestion to experiment with just different ways of relating to the mind. This suggestion, this thought of, you know, like, who created this? You know, we created this. And what is my part in that in terms of intention and volition? But I do have some capacity. I'm not a victim. Until I explore my potential, then I never really know what's possible. It's, you know, thinking outside the box. That's a common kind of phrase these days. Kind of lateral thinking, exploration. That you know, the present moment tour, set it up. I did that one time with a theatre group I was involved with. We had a mystery bus tour, and we rented a bus and blacked out all the windows and blindfolded everybody and led them on the bus, and the bus driver kind of, you know, we went round and round in circles and up and down, and then we had different spaces set up. People were led out blindfold. We had a marquee set up inside a hall, so people were led inside the hall, and when they took their blindfolds off, they were inside a marquee, and we had tape recordings of kind of animals and trying to create this altered perceptions, just challenging the nature of the way we apprehend reality. It was fun. Where am I? I close my eyes sometimes. I mean, travelling a lot. Close my eyes. Wake up in the morning sometimes. I think, where am I? I'm in a strange bed. Which country am I in? And I get that sometimes. Kind of grasping for conventional reference points to recreate myself. Who am I? I'm a monk. Oh, the rope, got the rope, it's all right. I'm safe. I had that in, I travelled from, where was it from? I had this funny thing from Latvia down through Lithuania to Poland, back to Latvia to Finland, back to Lithuania, back to Latvia to England, and somewhere in there they lost my luggage. Which didn't really surprise me. Anyway, I arrived in England basically with what I was wearing, and I went to a friend's place, and she lent me some of her husband's clothes. So while what I was wearing was being laundered, another friend came round to visit me and saw me in the back garden in jeans and t-shirts. To find a piece of brown cloth or something, re-establish my identity. It's okay, I'm still me. And we do that. We do have the whole structure of masks and symbols and signs linguistically and culturally and in terms of gender and all sorts of things to substantiate this thing called me. We've just somehow... we have to let it all go. All of it. And this abiding in the present moment is you know, Dhamma, because the present moment is truly timeless. It has no beginning and it has no end. Conventionally, we have an image of dots. You know, now, 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 now. And that movie Groundhog Day, that was quite a nice... like it's oh God, now again. I want something new, something fresh. And the language, you know, it doesn't really, because that which is timeless, that which is eternal, that which is ineffable, it's ineffable. There's nothing that can be said, but it can be experienced. So I have this kind of Monty Python sitcom, and I play around with these ideas almost to try and trick myself into being in that space, to kind of to somehow kick myself out of the rut of this me thing. Oh, me again. I have to somehow get out of that, and that is quite a challenge. It is difficult. Faith is very... a pilgrim of St. Anthony was telling that he'd met a sage in the cave in the Himalayas or wherever they were going, and he was kind of beseeching this wise sage to show him the path. Show me the path. And the sage kind of says, there is no path. There is only the abyss. No, show me the path. All paths lead to earth. only the abyss leads to God. Jump! And it's, we have to do that, in a sense. Like, to truly abide in the present moment is truly an act of faith. And much of monastic life is geared up around that. That I don't, in terms of possessing the precious, having the power, monastic life is deliberately set up so that have very little control, very little power. So each day really has to be approached as an act of faith. That something will happen, I'll get fed, there'll be somewhere to stay, that I'll meet some people that will kind of help me or, you know, befriend me. And I travelled for a couple of years in Europe kind of on that basis. I was just kind of round and around continental Europe. And there was that kind of anxiety. Who's going to meet me? I'd be travelling to a country. I never met the people. Had no idea what they knew about monks or whether they would, how it would all work out. The choices are, you know, being anxious or just trusting that somehow the goodness of my life will have a good result. And I must have done some bad things because it wasn't all good. Anyone surprised? But overall, it was kind of okay. It worked out. And here I am, having a great time. Lunch every day, got a nice room with a view. I mean, these similes, you know, that about a rich man going through the eye of a needle and, you know, being his little children, and the more you give, the more you get. The present moment is a gift that we receive, that we give, that we receive. We're both giving and receiving. And this is the reciprocal nature of nature. Giving and receiving. Again, monastic life very much depended on giving. And curiously, I found it more difficult to receive than to give. The practice of dana is the practice of giving, the practice of generosity. But it for there to be a gift, there has to be a giving and a receiving. And what it's primarily about is giving and receiving. It's not, we tend to focus on the gift. That's a natural, you know, what did they give you? But in the monastery, the practice of dana, people would come and bring things, give me things. Another toothbrush, another pair of socks. The practical mind says, oh, I've already got a toothbrush, thanks. Take your gift away. Not very nice. Doesn't matter. You know, I mean, the practical mind said that, seeing more to just focus on the giving and the receiving. And this kind of this point of connection, which is actually very beautiful. Just somebody giving a kind word or giving a physical gift. It's irrelevant. It's about establishing that point of connection, and in that connection is acceptance. It's like, I accept you, I accept your gift. I accept this moment as it is. This is a kind of a flowering, this connection. It's based or it's threaded through with love. That's what acceptance is. That's what the present moment is kind of made of, ideally or potentially, if we can truly receive this gift. A definition of hell I like as being eternally denied the presence of God. God's presence. Like Santa Claus. No more presents. It's hell. To never be given. I mean, in this Gollum in The Lord of the Rings, with ultimate power, you see in this position becomes ultimate alienation. To be truly and utterly alone. He'd possessed the ring, and all of these characters, Saruman, some of you may didn't see the movie, but the guys in power, they were all alone on top of a big tower. All their minions were down there going, oh, wonderful, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. But they were so alone in their position of power. So there's something nice about just being in the marketplace, grooving and bopping with the people. Nothing special, earthworm practice. Giving and receiving. And it's such a, we do get those moments. I mean, I also, the drawing that the child gives. Or just the things that children give in innocence. They can be quite outlandish sometimes, but they're given in such sincerity and innocence. Like I was on the subway in Toronto, this little girl sat opposite me. She had big, thick glasses on, so I don't know how well she could see. But she was with her father, and she turned to her father and said, "That lady's got a pretty dress on." Everyone, I just got a feel everywhere. I'm in a really loud voice. Everyone in the subway's gone. It was so nice. I gave her a big smile. She smiled back. This kind of being acknowledged, being given this kind of, it was a compliment. She gave me a compliment. Thank you. When those things come through confusion, delusion, you know, the agendas, through all of the masks, the armoring, the perceptions, the filters, all of that, doesn't work. We're incredibly sensitive in that way in terms of authenticity and honesty. When a gift is given, is freely given, is given through kindness, through love, how beautiful that is, and how sensitive we are, even to the smallest, the most subtle kind of gesture. And it all happens here, in the present moment. Very beautiful. Anyway, I'll leave that with you. Thank you.